Former law professor Duncan Webb with us on the panel now, with Lane Neave in Christchurch, and in Auckland, Steve McCabe, physics teacher, pilot and geek. Good afternoon, Steve and Duncan.
Good afternoon.
Actually, you're back being a pilot now, Steve.
Yes, I am. It's been about 8 years since I last got myself in the cockpit of a plane. I used to fly an awful lot in the United States when I was I lived there. I was working as a flight instructor for a while.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic job, getting paid to teach other people to fly. Just didn't get paid very much. And so in the end, I had to give it up just because I simply couldn't feed the family on it, and got a real job like teaching, and have always hankered for the skies ever since. And over the last few years, I watch planes flying overhead, and I think, you know, that really should be me. So finally, over the last school holidays, I finally scratched the itch. Finally got myself back to Ardmore Airport, went to local flight school, and started flying again, and it has been the most wonderful experience. I have American licenses, which now need to be converted to New Zealand licenses. Obviously, the planes fly the same. You know, it's exactly the same in New Zealand. You know, if you push the stick forward, the houses get bigger. It works exactly the same in terms of the physics of it.
And the air's the same.
Obviously, of course, when you go into a spin, you go the opposite direction in the southern hemisphere, obviously. But apart from that, everything is basically the same. But, you know, there's air law, there's airspace regulations, there's all kinds of stuff that I need to learn basically from scratch, because things are just sufficiently subtly different.
What's the best thing about flying a plane?
That's impossible to answer.
Go on, one sentence.
There is something absolutely unbeatable when you're about 6,000 feet up over what basically suddenly looks genuinely like Middle Earth. It really does. East Auckland, out going toward Kawakawa Bay, Clevedon, that kind of area, from about 5,000, 6,000 feet, you expect to see hobbits. You genuinely do. It is exquisitely beautiful. But there is no thrill in the world that I've found quite like pulling off a good landing. I can do it all day, and I would if it wasn't so bloody expensive. But my first landing in 8 years, I was lined up on final, and everything was in the green, everything was lined up, nose was straight down the centre line, and I just thought, this feels right. This is what I'm meant to be doing. And like I say, first landing in 8 years, and the wheels squeaked down the runway. The instructor sitting next to me actually applauded me, and I felt very, very good about this.
Oh, you're showing off now.
Oh, I was so proud of myself. This was fantastic. And so I'll be flying again. We've got a couple of flights booked this week, and it's just a question now of getting a few hours in. There's a few things we have to do in New Zealand that you don't do in the US, like mountain awareness, terrain awareness flying. That's just not part of the American training syllabus.
Not in Florida, I wouldn't think.
No, not really. I was taught that most of the hills in Florida, and so it's not something I've got exposed to. So now, just there's a few new experiences, but yeah, it just feels wonderful.
The 9/11 flyers learnt to fly in Florida, didn't they? They were taught by flight schools down there.
I taught at Jones Aviation in Sarasota, where Mohammed Atta took flight lessons.
Really?
Long before I was there, I hastened to. I never met the guy, but I worked with people who did fly with him. And they obviously had no clue of where he was going, what he was up to. But they said there was something deeply, deeply wrong about the bloke. And so just for a quick shameless plug, if there is anybody listening to this who happens to have use for a multi-engine instrument-rated commercial pilot...
What?
Get in touch with us through Radio New Zealand.
So you're going to check on your day job?
Well, if somebody wants to offer me a flying job, you know where to get hold of me. Shameless plug, shameless and blatant.
Duncan Webb, anything you want to shift on trade me or anything like that? No, nice to have you back on. Now, you've had quite a lot happening as usual in your life, haven't you? You've been skiing
for a
start. Yeah,
I've been having a bit of fun. Yeah, being skiing, I love taking the kids up there. Like you say, I doubt it's quite like flying, but once you're up there and you can look out across the plains, and even your worries seem a little bit smaller when you're that far away, so it's lovely.
Mm. And you've been overseas too.
Yes, I went to, of all places, Sri Lanka, and everyone says, what on earth made you think of that? And it was one of those things, and I've done this before, when you're on the internet and you think, well, it'd be great to get away, and you're going through the House of Travel website or something, you think, well, Sri Lanka doesn't seem so bad. So it was school holiday, so I booked the tickets and then told Tanya, my wife, that we're off, and that all we needed was a backpack, and we'll be fine. And she filled in the gaps from there.
Well, what was the experience like?
Well, look, fantastic, but you wouldn't call it relaxing. You know, we arrived in Colombo, which I'm told is not quite like Delhi or Mumbai or anything like that, but it was absolutely manic and sort of 30 degrees and just traffic everywhere and no footpaths and little three-wheeler tuk-tuks and everything. And then there was, of course, then there was the food and so on. On one occasion, we were travelling between two cities and Tanya managed to get her wallet stolen on one of the trains from the hotel into the main station. That caused a bit of a delay, so we missed the next train. And while we were waiting at the train station, my children started vomiting. And so, you know, it's just one of those days when you think, this is what memories are made of.
Thanks, Dad. Thanks, Dad. Great holiday.
I did pat one of my children on the back as he was vomiting out of the side of the train at full speed.
I'm sure that made him feel so much better.
Well, I said to him, I got a lot of admiration for him. I said to him, this will be a story to tell when you get back to school. And he gave me a wry smile. I was like, yeah, Dad, good on you. I'm glad he was feeling ill because he probably would have socked me if he wasn't.
And just quickly, the Christchurch mayoralty, are you involved at all with the campaigning?
Not direct. Well, I probably will be when it heats up a bit, to be fair, with Leanne Dalzell. You know, and it's really interesting to watch. Of course, the building consent crisis in Christchurch didn't help Bob Parker at all, who's now pulled out. And I think there's some casting around for other mayoral candidates. And to be fair, it will be good if we do have another genuine contender, as they say, because at the moment it looks a bit like a one-horse race. And I'd hate people not to take it seriously and not to turn up and vote whichever way, you know, they view it. But
Who would that be?
That's a fascinating question. You hear all kinds of names bandied about, sure. But I'm yet to hear one that that's really got a ring of truth about it. But you know, it'll be good to see if someone does come out and you know give it a good push.
Fonterra is how we're starting today, of course. And joining us shortly will be Dr. Paul Harrison from Deakin University in Melbourne, because mainly we want to talk about international perception. I suppose there are local aspects, and we've puzzled about them through the day. I think it's been described as a rapidly evolving state of information by Fonterra or some such organisation party to the whole thing. So two aspects to the Fonterra Whey recall. First, you're a global company, aren't you, with a big marketing department, and you know on a Wednesday that an infant formula using your whey protein could be tainted, and on a Saturday people still said to be buying it off the shelves, and you blame procedural issues. Do you get the feeling it hasn't been handled very adroitly?
Well, if it's still on the shelves after they've identified a significant botulism causing toxin within the product, then yeah, someone's messed up.
The Fonterra has no other asset than the appropriateness of its product as a food, you know, and it this strikes at the very core of it. And, you know, and there's plenty of examples of defective products and food products. And it's been shown time and time again that the only thing you can do right is recall it all and recall it immediately. And this just, it looks like it's been an effort at damage control when the only thing you can do is put public safety first.
Fonterra share value down 3.5%, it came back to today, dollar down a cent. We're not clear still, are we, how the first signs of a problem could have emerged in March and the problem is announced nearly in August? Does that still puzzle you? Would you like to know a whole lot more, a whole lot quicker, I suppose, is the question.
Well, how did the information even come out? Presumably, you have to figure that back in March, somebody inside the company knew about it.
Well, knew something.
Yeah, knew something. Something was amiss. Oh, because as you said, it was a developing information state, did you say? It's a fantastic euphemism.
A rapidly evolving state of information.
There you go. So at some point, somebody knew something about something. At which point, what happened at that stage? What was known? At what level within the company? And did somebody make a decision to carry on business as usual, knowing there was an issue? At what point was that decision made?
It's the size of the issue known. That's the obvious central point.
This sounds very much to me like the Melamine scandal, which had exactly the same informational delays and very significant health risks. And you thought, why did they not learn then? You know, and one of the real problems is that you know, this is a very, very large multinational company, and it's very difficult to get inside it. If this was a domestic company in New Zealand, selling only in New Zealand, we'd know very quickly what went wrong and why, because we've got regulatory control over it. But because this entity has so many tendrils, we simply won't know what's going on in China and other parts of the world.
And speaking of regulatory control, how do you end up with a dirty pipe, whatever a dirty pipe is in dairying terms, in the first place? But it's the effect and what the rest of the world thinks that, of course, is of main concern, because no one, touch wood, may contract botulism from this. Dr. Paul Harrison is a senior lecturer in consumer psychology from Deakin University in Melbourne, and he is kindly joining us now. Good afternoon, Paul.
Hi there, Jim.
In simple terms, it's got to be a bad sign when countries like China and Russia start distancing themselves, you'd think?
Oh yeah. and I think that's the thing, is that China and Russia both also have brand recognition, and people would look at China and think, well, you know, China's always hiding information and keeping information from its people. The moment that a country like China or a country like Russia say, we don't want your products, that augurs very badly for the brand. But also, I guess, it casts what we call a halo effect over the idea of brand New Zealand as well, because so much of New Zealand's brand is built around that 100% pure idea.
Right, so you're saying, in a sense, it's made worse because we have a perception of China and Russia that they are sloppier than us in terms of regulatory control, quality control. So when they are closing the doors, it makes what we're doing seem even worse.
Yeah, and perception is everything in branding. It's not whether they are or they aren't, or whether New Zealand has got more stringent controls or China or Russia. But, you know, the fact that you guys were just talking about the melamine kind of scandal, I'm sure that a lot of people, particularly maybe even people in New Zealand, although Fonterra were connected with that, would have said, oh, yeah, but that's, you know, that's how China is. They hide things. It's a communist democracy, so to speak. And therefore, they would be kind of course, that's how they behave. But because Fonterra is so closely linked now with New Zealand, and because, I guess, the company itself and it happened in the country as well, people are going to make those connections. They're going to look at New Zealand and say, if China and Russia are closing the doors, where does New Zealand fit into this, even though it might challenge this idea of 100% pure? And again, in terms of our perceptions, we're constantly looking at information and weighing up what we believe is truth and what isn't truth. And what's really important about this particular one is that it is a worldwide news story, and people tend to look to their news services, even something like Fox, for example, as the truth, and then they look for how they form their opinions around that truth.
Okay, and we've had melamine. We've had a few, not all of which have gone global or known globally, but we've had our meat sitting on the Chinese wharves with the meat certification blunder, and we had the business with Zespri and its Chinese subsidiary, and the smuggling charges. So we've had a number of them. Is there a cumulative effect, do you think, Dr. Paul Harrison, in terms of a deteriorating image problem for New Zealand?
Yes, and perceptions of brand is incremental. So what we'll do initially, if we form an opinion around a brand or a country, we'll look for as much evidence as possible to support that opinion, and even when that opinion is challenged, we'll look for you know, sometimes people talk about the bad apples and things like that. We'll say, well, that was just a one-off. But our perception of a brand, our perception of the things that we want to choose, how we make our decisions, is incrementally influenced. And often a large scandal that goes on for a long period of time tends to chip away at our trust in a particular brand or our trust in any kind of slogan or idea that's built around a brand or even a country brand.
Okay, so all this militates against the clean and green, 100% pure brand, etc. So what should Fonterra do to avoid the long-term repercussions, Paul?
Apologise instantly. And as, I don't know if it was Duncan or Steve said, the first thing you do when there's a scandal is that you recall everything and you say, we made a mistake. You don't want to keep doing that because people stop believing you and you change systems. But what they need to do now is that they say, we mucked up. We didn't do this right, and we need to fix this, and this is what we're going to do to fix it, and we're going to come back to you every week, and we're going to tell you exactly what we've done to make sure that this never happens again. And it's very much about reforming that trust relationship with your public, it will take a while for people to trust them again. And I think one of the things that John Key has done, which is good, is that he's come out and he's said that this is our largest company, our largest brand, our largest exporter. We need to actually do something about that. And getting the government involved in such a big issue, I think, is a good thing. But also saying that what the government is going to do to make sure that this never happens again is also important.
It's got to be more than, presumably, it's got to be more than cosmetic, Paul. You've also got to come out and explain all the things that we began this conversation wondering about. You've got to actually tell as much truth as you can.
That's right. You've got to be open. And I think there's really no turning back now. They have to explain what happened, why it happened. As you were saying, how does botulism form in a pipe? Why isn't that picked up? And then, I think spin is a disaster in the world of business. You actually have to change your systems, and you have to say exactly what you've done to change your systems. And I'm involved. I'm a graduate of the company Institute of Company Directors, and one of the things that we always talk about is this idea of honesty with your shareholders and stakeholders, and change your systems. You actually don't just send out a press release. You change the way, and the directors of those companies should be doing that as well and coming out and saying exactly what they've done.
Okay, so at the moment it's not really, in terms of the need for that, being done that well, and it's possible repercussions at this stage anyway are reasonably serious?
I think so. I think as it continues to be a news story, as people start to remember all of the other connections and scandals. And also what we're dealing with here is something, I guess, a little bit less concrete. We're dealing with health. And when you talk about health, you know, people don't really know what's going on inside their bodies. And so, you know, to some degree, the trust in the brand is paramount. And they have to recognise that if you're saying that people could die from this, everybody is a potential victim of it. Anyone who uses the product, they need to recognise that they have a really serious issue on hand, and that they have to make sure that they have they change their systems, but also they say if anything happens, this is what we're going to do to help people to get through it as well.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Dr. Paul Harrison with us on the panel from Deakin University in Melbourne at 24 minutes past 4 o'clock. Now, Professor Colin Campbell-Hunt's about to join us too. Stand up, Otago is the thundering headline in the weekend's Otago Daily Times, in the light of job losses at Invermay, with jobs heading to Christchurch and Palmerston North. And the ODT says, time and time again, this newspaper's quoted MPs, government officials, local body politicians, business representatives and the like, speaking about the importance of decentralisation and the advantages of economic growth in the provinces. To which I suppose we could add that time and time again, going back quite a while, we've scratched our heads and asked the same questions about what seems to be such a no-brainer to many people, the advantages of decentralisation and the dangers of a bulging Auckland. And so I noticed Colin's been quoted on this over the weekend in the ODT. Do you yourselves look at Invermay and think, why? Why get rid of skilled jobs from an agricultural research facility right in the heart of agricultural land?
What was the thinking behind it? We don't have the information yet, do we, on why this decision was made?
I wouldn't say we have all the information, no.
And I guess it's perhaps a bit trite, but, you know, there's constant change in these things. And excuse me. The fact is that industries will come and go and grow and shrink, as will towns and so on. And I think you're right. The question is, well, where is the best place for these people in these industries? And it cuts across the board. All of the, you know, manufacturing is one where the manufacturers are constantly saying, well, you know, we should be supported in New Zealand. But the fact of the matter is that unless it's specialist manufacturing, New Zealand's not the best place to manufacture. And so we need to be very careful about supporting things for the sake of it, when in fact growth should be in different areas of the economy.
Okay, well, let's get to that then. Otago University's head of the Department of Accountancy and Finance, Professor Colin Campbell-Hunt, joining us now. Colin, good afternoon.
I was going to say, yeah, that last voice was not mine. It sounded like it was going to be. But that's somebody else. G'day, good afternoon.
That was your former colleague, or not really colleague, but that was Duncan Webb.
Duncan Webb. Hello, Duncan.
Hello.
First of all, can you remind us of what agglomeration is and how it's related to the loss of the Invermay jobs?
Isn't it a wonderful word, eh? It's an economic process whereby, if left to themselves, it makes a lot of sense for businesses to gather together. At all kinds of levels, you know, why are car yards always in the same place? Well, because they attract customers, and you know that's much easier. At a city level, all kinds of businesses are attracted to larger domestic markets. I mean, Dunedin 100 years ago was the commercial capital of this country, and as the population drifted north, the businesses went with it. So these are very natural economic processes, which they're driven by things like efficiency. You will do better, you will capture more economies of scale if you're co-located with a whole bunch of other similar businesses. So a place like Dunedin, other things being equal, if left to its own, is at the wrong end of that process.
And yes.
Places like Auckland will grow all by themselves. Places like Wellington also, places like Christchurch, you know, this process operates at all kinds of levels.
But Colin, this is, I think, as the Rob Campbell once said, this is economics on the head of a pin, isn't it? It's kind of assuming there's nothing regional or diversified about industry, but we're dealing with people and a nation, aren't we?
I'm not quite sure what head of a pin might mean. Go for it, if you can explain what that means.
Well, what it really means is that when economists look at the benefit of that kind of centralisation, right, they're not taking into account people and jobs and the need to keep regions buoyant.
I guess that's true. It's just looking at a set of drivers that, other things being equal, you know, the classic economist assumption, other things being equal, will lead to larger regional groupings. I think, you know, coming back, if I may, to the question that you first posed about Invermay, why is that a surprise or not a surprise? Within regions, there's a big and influential body of thinking in the economics profession over the last decade or two that look at regions as the source of international competitive advantage, okay? If you think of a place like Silicon Valley as a sort of the archetype of all of that kind of thing, but believe it or not, Dayton, Ohio is a world center for carpets, right?
Right.
There is a story behind all of those things. So when you look at international competitiveness, and crucially that is so important for us in New Zealand, when you look at international competitiveness on a global scale, very often those advantages are actually regionally based rather than nationally based. So in Dunedin, where we have been, you know, the whole city has been scratching its head about how to build on these advantages, it's fairly clear that we do have strengths as a knowledge-based economy, okay?
Yeah.
And in particular, one could point to microbiology and to all of the scientific foundations of agricultural science and technology. And there's no question that the University of Otago, and I'm not blowing the university's trumpet here, I mean, this is just sort of factual stuff, has world-class researchers in these areas who have in turn formed really productive scientific partnerships with colleagues at Invermay. So it is, puzzling would be a polite word for it.
Makes no sense. All right.
It's hard to see the logic for breaking up that kind of capability, which has the potential to add real value.
Okay, but should those advantages be left for the market to develop? Or, as I think Stephen Joyce believes, for the regions to take the initiative on? Well, that's the thing. To what extent should government be involved?
Well, government is involved, as I think Mr. Joyce has said in the ODT. Government puts is responsible for a huge amount of investment in this university and the Otago Poly and in places like Invermay. So, I mean, government is a player in this game. It's an economic player, whether it likes it or not. I think the answer to your question is that all three levels are doing what they can, you know, to advance their own interests. Businesses will take their decisions, I personally would have no difficulty in those decisions being driven entirely by profit, you know, and this is where agglomeration comes in. So if there are natural economic advantages to shifting to Auckland, then businesses are going to do that. And I don't think I personally would not be one for discouraging that kind of movement with, you know, the kind of Muldoonist interventions that used to happen 30 years ago. No.
Yeah, I know, but people have made the point that, you know, how does the square, the Stephen Joyce opinion, if you like, where the regions should promote themselves, how does the square with the call from Nick Smith for councils to stick to core business? I mean, how can you be entrepreneurial when the mood is you should just be fixing the potholes?
Well, I think, you know, Dunedin is very cheerfully being entrepreneurial and encouraging all kinds of conversations around the city, which people like me have been involved with over the years. And this is not the expenditure of big chunks of money. This is not, spending ratepayers' money on you know, huge subsidies for local businesses. That's not the game. It's just trying to share ideas and trying to share strategic commitments. And crucially, coming back to your fundamental question here, one of those key players is government. And, you know, government needs to be part of the strategic dance as much as anybody else does. And that is why, you know, a decision by government to kind of forget about the knowledge potential, the knowledge-based industry potential of this area seems bizarre.
All right, thank you. Professor Colin Campbell-Hunt from the University of Otago. We've kind of run out of time to discuss. I mean, we do bite this topic off in chunks, I think, to a reasonable degree on the panel. But are we doing regional development, Duncan, do you suspect, anywhere near well enough?
Well, I think one of the difficulties is that everyone wants to be, an international centre of excellence for something. We've just got to be careful that we don't all try to be the same thing, because there's a real danger that, you know, everyone wants to be the, you know, agricultural science centre. I mean, I've got Lincoln University around the corner here, and, you know, I know Massey University does a whole lot of work in that area as well. You know, and you've got those kind of problems where you've just got to make sure, I think, and I think this is the place for central government, and it's largely coordination to make sure that it facilitates that kind of thing and make sure that in the international sphere we're not sort of cutting across each other, because that's utterly counterproductive.
But unless there's a place for everyone, you end up neglecting whole rural and small town swathes of New Zealand in the end, and that must be economically counterproductive.
Oh, I think that's right. In the same breath, you know, large parts of New Zealand are essentially, in Christchurch is a good example, where a large part of its economy is agricultural service. We, you know, we're a wheat exporter and a seed exporter and so on. Mm. We've got to recognise that that's actually what we're good at. Seeds in Christchurch are enormous. We have carrot seeds for the rest of the world. Now, that might not be glamorous, but it's actually a really good industry, and a whole lot of industry out there fixes tractors and makes seeding machines and so on, and that's a really important part of our economy. And I think you just got to recognise that just because it's agricultural doesn't mean that it's not really important and part of a, you know, part of a vibrant economic community.
Duncan Webb, Steve McCabe on the panel, back with them shortly. Catriona standing by with the news headlines.